will end up needing hospitalization. And the health staff of hospitals is totally burnt out. The repercussions in health services will go on for 30 years. There are a lot of people who are retiring prematurely and giving up medicine in all kinds of categories of health care because of the hell that they've gone through the last few years. And I certainly hope that that's not required again. I don't think so. Again, I'm sort of guardedly optimistic, at least, in the states where they've had reasonable practices enforced, so among them New York. So I think it'll just be a bit of a heavy bump, but not a disastrous one for us in New York City, New York State, and I wish well to the rest of the country and to the entire world. Someone has to kind of push out a lot of messenger RNA vaccines into the third world. Otherwise, we're going to have other variants. See, this is not the end. The problem is if you don't address the people who are under-vaccinated, you offer the virus an opportunity to mutate once again into something new and different. And I don't want anything new and different. I hope everyone gets their act together, but I'm guardedly optimistic here.
WS2N, yeah, very good, Roy. If you don't have your booster, I'm out in Suffolk County, so it's getting a little bit more difficult. I went a few weeks ago, so I had no problem. In fact, out here in Stony Brook Hospital, still has their system up and running, which is terrific. You go in and it's real mass production, no problem. They have a National Guard guiding people in, no problem. But you do have to make an appointment. And now, if you bring up an appointment now, it says no appointments available. So now you have to go rooting around, to CVS or something. But, it's getting more difficult. Sign up now, because I understand it takes like a week or so before that booster actually kicks in anyway. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, you got to give your immune system an opportunity to recognize what it has and react to it. Another aspect that I didn't mention was antibodies always decrease over time. When you're vaccinated, you get a lot of antibodies to those proteins present in your blood serum, and over time, your immune system slowly diminishes the amount of those antibodies. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't diminish the lymphocytes that are trained to react to those antigens. So your immune system, even though your antibody titers might dip low and your initial infectiousness might be undermined, you still have T cells that know how to deal with this infection, and that also is probably going to be a factor in the limited expression of the infection not leading to the severe inflammatory processes and hospitalizations as much. So, again, it's a good idea to be vaccinated. God, if you weren't vaccinated and there's no contraindication, please get vaccinated. If you've been vaccinated, and it's been about 6 months, please get your booster. It might be difficult here. I think it's more of a regional thing because I've heard rumors that there are some locations in the United States where the idea that you now need a booster shot is being used as some kind of reverse logic of, well, then all this vaccination stuff is nonsense anyway, so why should I bother with a vaccine booster? Because they're just going to tell me I need another one. I had breakfast this morning, and some idiot said I'm going to need another breakfast tomorrow morning. So I the logic eludes me personally, but please, everyone out there, take care of yourselves and your loved ones and each other, and get the booster shot.
Uh, Okay, and you mentioned the T-cells. I read about them, but I don't know where they are, where are they located in your body. And apparently you're saying, this is what I'm hearing anyway, that you're saying that the mRNA has affected the T-cells where they change to some degree and they recognize when you're being attacked by another coronavirus. I probably got this all fouled up. Back to you, Roy.
No, you got the gist of it. Lymphocytes are white blood cells. Most of them live in either your bone marrow, where blood elements are produced, or the lymph nodes. You might notice when you have an infection occasionally, you get these swollen nodes. Those are your lymphatic nodes, and what's happening is they have a cluster of white blood cells. They're very sensitive to infection. They multiply and send out killer cells and produce antibodies, and so they get swollen and tender during some infections. What happens is when you got the vaccination, in addition to just producing a lot of antibodies, you produced a subset colony of white blood cells in your lymph nodes in your bone marrow that kind of were on a hairline trigger for the type of antigens that this vaccine presented it, so that anything close to a spike protein, these white blood cells will get really upset about and start to reproduce and spew out antibodies and killer cells that kind of travel through the bloodstream slowly and engulf infected areas. So there's more than one method that our immune system utilizes to fight off infection. The antibodies is very easy to test because it's just a simple blood test. The T cell lymphocytes, unfortunately, you would have to either do a surgical excision of a lymph node, which most people would not enjoy, or a bone marrow aspiration, which most people wouldn't enjoy. So that's a much more difficult thing to research, but they have done it in limited numbers and found that the amount of activity seems to remain reasonably the same. So that's not our problem. We still have that secondary immunological response to both the original COVID virus and even the variants seem to cause these T cells to wake up and react.
This bone marrow test, I mean, you said people wouldn't enjoy it. I mean, is this something where you're awake with it doing it, or? Or is it just the aftermath, they knock you out, and the recovery that bothers people?
No, it's usually not done under general anesthesia because general anesthesia has its own inherent risks. It's invasive. It just think of someone, coring an apple and doing that on your hip bone. They can give you painkillers. They can give you tranquilizers. It's still an incredibly uncomfortable experience. And so if you need it because of some leukemia or something, then it's something that one has to suffer. But as a research project, it's probably very difficult to get people to volunteer. When I cited the original studies where they found people to volunteer, I mentioned that they were great people to do that because I don't know quite if I would volunteer to have a bone marrow aspiration.
Yeah, you got, hundreds of bones. What bone do they take it out of?
Usually it's the hip bone. It's the kind of the biggest one that you can't miss and you can't do too much damage to it.
That doesn't sound good. When you get older, is it the hip bones? When people fall, it's always the hip bone that finishes people off. I don't know. Couldn't they go out of another bone, a smaller bone somewhere, a hand or a foot or something?
No, I didn't mean the thigh bone. I meant the pelvis. You know, the if you've ever seen a picture of a skeleton, our pelvis is this kind of round shape. It has two wings, and the bottom of the spine attaches to it. So it's the pelvic bone. It's a long, flat bone. It's all over the place. Right past the buttocks, and you can't break it, because it's very big. If you bore a little hole into it, nothing is damaged. If you try and do it on smaller bones, you might make it weaker, and it could break at some point. So it's not the leg bone that goes into the pelvis. It's the actual pelvic bone that's spread out to both sides of the base of the trunk of the body.
Very good, Roy. Okay. Learn something new every day. Thank you. Back to you.
You're welcome, Paul. Thanks for bringing up the subject. I thought it would be a good thing to discuss tonight, because it's in the news and in the Times and all over the place. Anyone else out there with any questions at this point? Please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, very well. I do want to add that Jeff, AB6MB, who couldn't quite get through to our Reco link, wanted to mention that Rob Sherwood of the Sherwood Receiver List did a YouTube for the Papa Network, and that's available on YouTube. I posted it on my link page. I also, as I mentioned earlier, posted Wesley's CIA paper on ferrite antennas, so you can look at them at your leisure. As always, if you need to reach me and you can't do it on the radio, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, that's for either mailbag questions or topics for discussion or puzzlers. If you want to contact Paul, of course, you could do it through me, or you could just go through his spacenetreport@gmail.com. Link page, again, take a look at it, full of interesting stuff. Just type in roy.ac2gs.com, and we have a stream of Glen Oaks Repeater. You just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, of course, keep in mind MyKC2NJI's wonderful archive. He has more than a million visitors, amateurradio.tv, archives the technical net as far back as September of 2006. So keep that all in mind. And, again, wanted to thank everyone who participated tonight. You guys make or break a technical net, so I do appreciate it. And I'll be back a little bit later on to say good night, but please come back next Sunday night, and we'll try and do this all over again. Right now it is 10:14, soon to be 10:15, and perfect time for Paul, WS2N's SpaceNet Report.
Very good, Roy, thanks. And by the way, if you check the chat room, you'll see Chris and I were discussing a lot of topics, but one of the things we came up with was the picture and the information I sent to you that you put on your website. I want to change the temperature. What do I have? I think at 488 Fahrenheit, but we're missing a minus sign, so Chris found that. So maybe you get a chance to change it. You'll see that in the writings. Back to you, Roy, before I start.
Okay, yeah, you guys were typing away. Usually, if it's a couple of comments here and there, I can read when people take a breath on the net, but people weren't taking too much breaths, and you and Chris were typing away, so I didn't have an opportunity to actually follow the conversation in anything close to real time. I will look it up and figure out where I dropped the negative sign and plug it in.
Yeah, you didn't drop it. I dropped it when I emailed it to you without the negative sign. But normally, on something like that, no big deal. But one good thing about Roy's website, everybody, you send something to him, if it's good and he puts it up, it stays forever. You could look back on a lot of different nets, and he's got all these different stories and everything. And it looks like it's good till the end of time. Anyway, I was going to discuss a couple of topics. We have quite a few to go through, but just the main ones are really the first ones that we have on the list. 1, 2, and 3 are the main topics I'd like to get to. And one, of course, is the James Webb Space Telescope, which is finally supposed to launch now on December 24th, which is Christmas Eve. But they plan on launching it at 7:20 in the morning. And it's been delayed for years. I remember talking to Roy and even Dick about James Webb Space Telescope many years ago. It was supposed to launch in 2017. That was the year, I think, the earliest predicted launch. And then they had problems here, problems there. They needed to fix the sunshade, all kinds of problems. When they opened it up, there was things breaking and not holding together. You know, when they were testing things, it all had to be reworked and done. And Northrop Grumman is the primary contractor on this. And they sent it through tests, acoustic tests, where they would have all kinds of dBs duplicating the sounds of launch and chilling it down to super temperatures, seeing if it would hold up in minus 488 degree temperatures. Over the years, past all the tests, they finally put it on a big barge and sent it from California through the Panama Canal, and now it's located in South America to be launched from French Guiana, Kourou Launch Complex that the European Space Agency uses. And that will be launched on an Ariane 5 rocket. And we'll have to see how it goes on Christmas Eve. It was delayed. It was going to be, I think the 22nd was one day, and now they change it to the 24th. But let me drop it a second. WV2EAV. Oh, okay. We'll go to you. And we'll see. We'll see how this goes. This thing has been delayed so many times, and the most recent problem was the cable going from the telescope level all the way down to the base into mission control. Intermittent problems, and that's why it was delayed. Apparently, they fixed it, and what kind of a cable it was eventually, maybe. And but the problem was, apparently, they have that fixed, and that's why they have the new confirmed date. Over to you, Ed.
It took a few minutes to occur to me, but isn't absolute zero minus 459? F, and you're saying minus 488.
Maybe that's wrong. Might have been a complete typo that I got wrong. 448, correction. I'm looking at it here now. 448. I'm not sure what's on the website. Royal fix it though. If I have that number wrong as well. I'm showing minus 448. They needed to get down to, and that's not absolute zero. That's down to 7 degrees Kelvin.
Yeah, a few degrees above absolute zero is fairly standard for that sort of stuff.
Yes, okay. Yeah, they have this, I put it on his, on Roy's website, picture of the cryo cooler that's involved with this project. And, without cooling anything, just with the sunshades and just keeping all the equipment away from the sun, they're going to get down to, I think, 38 or 40 degrees Kelvin. That'll be the temperature that some of the detectors, infrared detectors, will be working on. But they have one on there, and it's called MIRI. And MIRI needs to be operated at this 7 or slightly below 7 degree Kelvin temperature. So they have this cryo cooler cascade type of system attached to the web. They have a picture, and that's actually one of the pictures that we put onto Roy's site, and they showed this guy standing next to it, so you get an idea roughly how big this setup is. And it's got these pistons that oppose one another, so one is compressing and then the other one is releasing the helium gas. They're using a helium gas as a refrigerant. As it goes back, the other piston will compress, the other one will just be in the discharge mode. This way there's no vibration. Last thing you need on a telescope that's supposed to be holding steady is any kind of vibration. You want to eliminate that down to zero if they can. But yet, at the same time, they need to operate this thing at 7 degrees Kelvin or slightly below. And they have this 30-foot stainless steel coil tubing, so slightly flexible. At the launch, this thing is going to rise away from the base, around 30 feet. So this cryogenic cooler is located in the base itself, just right below the sun shield. The sun shields are roughly the size of a tennis court. There's five layers of them, this Mylar insulation system that, when it unfurls, it's going to be that big. It's big as a tennis court. Below that is going to be this cooling device. And that has a connection.
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
That's what I was waiting for. Okay, I was going on and on. All right, anyway, this block of copper, perhaps a little smaller in my hand, will get very cold. That's the part that gets cold. The charge, a couple of devices attached to that, and that's the receiving. That'll be receiving the light waves from this 21-foot diameter foot mirror. So the refrigeration device is below the Mylar insulation, and yet the tubing comes up through it on a flex connection, the stainless steel flex connection. The diameter of the tubes, they set around 2 millimeters, so it's very small, and they're using helium, and we'll see how this all works. I mean, a lot of things have to happen, but this is one of the main detectors. They have four different detecting type systems on board the James Webb Space Telescope, and this one is the one that's going to work at a very cold temperature. The other ones work at passive, they call it passive system. They don't need any cooling because the cooling is going to be done by the sunshades. But this one, they actually have an active system to bring it even lower than the, let's call it the ambient temperature at that location. So let's see how James Webb does. Hopefully it gets off the ground. I mean, they're really rolling the dice on Christmas Eve, launching this thing. they're hoping for a non-Hubble problem. And the Hubble went up. It took them 3 years to work things out. Took a space shuttle and, you know, five people to go up there to service it on multiple spacewalks to get that thing working. You can't do that on this one. It's going out to the L2, Lagrange Point 2 location, four times the distance of where the moon is, and there won't be any visiting space shuttles to repair anything if it's broken. I hope the engineers got it right so the scientists can get their information back. It's still going to take around 5 months or so to calibrate everything. You know, once it's out there, the actual science won't be started until probably May. We'll see. We'll be reporting on the last TechNet on whether or not this thing was successful. You'll see it on the news. I mean, this is a $10 billion project. That's a lot of money for one launch, one particular spacecraft to be launched. Most expensive one that's ever been put into space. They all got their fingers crossed. Any questions or comments? Okay, another spacecraft that made it into the news last week. It's on a couple of stations. Is the Parker Solar Probe. We covered that here on the net when that thing got launched back in 2018. Since then, it's made over 20 orbits around the sun, each time getting closer and closer. I mean, it goes, you know, maybe out to the orbit of Venus, so it's elliptical, and then it goes in closer to the sun each time. And at this time, it got below the coronosphere, and there's pictures of like particles flying by on their camera. The temperatures soared to, I think, around 2,500 degrees. Spacecraft is being protected by this carbon-carbon shield that's 4 inches thick. Carbon-carbon is, you know, similar to the same material that they used on the leading edge wings of the shuttle when they were built. You know, highly resistive, able to withstand extreme temperatures. I remember people asking years ago, why wasn't the whole shuttle covered in carbon? Well, it would be too expensive. So they used these tiles, thousands, maybe 30,000 tiles attached to the space shuttle. Each one was individual, had to be shaped perfectly and glued in place on a space shuttle. And that was the way they resisted the heat for re-entry. But on a leading edge, the wings had carbon on it. Unfortunately, during the Columbia disaster, one of those carbon leading edge wings was compromised by boiling frozen insulation from the external tank of the shuttle, cracked the leading edge of the wing. Eventually, he got inside and compromised the aluminum structure, superstructure inside the shuttle on Columbia.
WB2EAV again.
Yes, that is WB2EAV, go ahead.
Yeah, regarding that heat shield failure on the space shuttle, when John Glenn orbited the first orbit of the Earth, they were afraid they had a heat shield problem. And I remember, I was a kid, but I remember it like it was yesterday, that they were worried that if there really was a heat shield problem, that was it. He was gone, but it turned out to just be a bad indication. So when I heard that the space shuttle broke up at the altitude that it did, I said, we've been waiting for this since John Lennon.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. That was an indicator for John Glenn. He was supposed to go for, well, I think, 5 or 7 orbits, but they cut him short of 3 orbits. So let's bring him back. And they decided to leave his, you know, you had these retro rockets that fired. They were attached to the, they were actually strapped to the outside of the spacecraft. The heat shield of John Glenn's spacecraft. So they decided, let's leave that on. That might be, this way, they were supposed to actually get rid of that, those engines after they fired to slow them down. But they said, let's leave it attached because there might be something loose with that heat shield and this will help hold it together. So, he really had a lot of sparks and things flying off. I mean, it is an abrasive shield meant to burn up and, to some degree, and you see sparks flying off, and that's what, it takes the heat away, during reentry. But he really had a lot of sparks coming off because they left that whole setup attached, and eventually that all, separated and burnt up, and allowing the heat shield to really do its job as it came through. But, it worked out okay. Like you said, it was an indicator. It really wasn't loose. The shield was not loose. So it stayed attached.
And if it was a real problem, that little stump with leaving those straps on, they would have burned off in 1 second flat, and that would have been it.
Yeah, I agree with it. They felt, well, leave it attached. If there is a loose heat shield, that's what they thought. The indicator was showing a loose heat shield. Not that it was separated, but something was loose. I agree. Well, he did good, and they brought him back safely. And they didn't have any other problems like that with the rest of the Mercurys that went up, with Carpenter and Sharar and Cooper. That all worked out okay. And I listened to a transcript. Actually more than a transcript, but an audio. They had an audio of his whole flight. You can get that on the internet now. You can hear the conversations that went back and forth. And he really was unaware of what they were talking about, possible situation. He was just told to leave don't disengage the retros after they get the fire them, just leave them on. So I think he pretty much knew what was going on when they told him that. Anyway, the Parker solar probe still doing good. Eventually, it will be going closer and closer to the sun. It will get below that 4 million mile location, which is, of course, it'll be even hotter then. They think that using this probe, one of the things that they can figure out is why the outer coronosphere is hotter than the surface. The surface, I think, is like 10,000 degrees or something, and the coronosphere is 1 million degrees. And there's always been, different theories on why that is. And one of the theories, of course, is the sound pressure is so loud. It's sound pressure is coming up, pushing against the coronosphere, making that hot. Anyway, they'll find all this out as time goes on, I'm sure. it was quite a flight when that thing launched, 2018. I'm going to talk about that here on the net. Launched on a Delta Heavy. Delta Heavy is, you know, NASA's fastest, most powerful spacecraft, and yet it was a small spacecraft, only, you know, maybe 1,000-pound payload. Why do they need this big, heavy launch vehicle? And they, you know, to launch to the sun, but they actually need to actually, you know, it's actually going in reverse, kind of like a retrograde type of orbit to eventually slow down. We're going 66,000 miles an hour around the sun. That's our relative speed. The thing has to slow down to way below that to, you know, to get to the slowest speed than Venus, the slowest speed than Mercury, going around the sun many thousands of miles. And by using a heavy-duty rocket like the Delta IV rockets both together, they're able to do that.
Paul, Echo Link has a question for you when it's time.
Thanks, Roy. You know, I haven't been unkeying. The only time I unkeyed a long period of time is when I timed it out. Let me unkey for a bit, and we'll pick up Echo Link. Not hearing anything, Roy.
Yeah, there might be a problem with Echolink because Jeff, AB6MB, earlier tonight also wanted to make a comment, and I thought I gave him enough time, and it just didn't register. So I think there's something blocking transmit, maybe at the repeater site or something, because I was looking to see if Kay transmitted, and she didn't. So I think it's an Echolink problem, probably needs to be rebooted.
Okay. But Kay, I know she has the ability to quickly get onto the chat room. Kay, if you do that, maybe we can pick you up and we'll build the question that way. And I have both repeaters on Selden. I didn't hear anything on Selden either, Roy. So there you go.
Okay, if I see anything from Echo Link, I'll let you know.
Okay, well, the chat room, you know, either one. Very good, thanks, Roy. There was another telescope that was launched last week. It was an X-ray telescope. It's going to complement or even probably maybe in some cases be better than the X-ray Chandra telescope that's been flying around since the late 90s. Chandra is highly elliptical. I mean, like 4,000 miles above the Earth to, you know, 80,000 miles out above the Earth, you know, maybe a third of the way to the moon, and that's the orbit Chandra takes, and it's been taking pictures with X-ray technology for decades. Now there's another one that's called the X-ray Polarimeter Explorer, IXPE, that was launched by SpaceX telescope. The SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket that I think was launched, and it's now on around 350 miles up, and I think it's 20 degrees inclination, so it's not a high inclination. So apparently that thing is now up and operational. It was launched naturally in a tight fit in a Falcon 9 fairing. And they have large fairings, I think 17-foot diameter fairing. But they needed to extend the boom around 30, I think it's a little over 30 feet, which was successfully done, you know, how to do this origami type of unfurling. So again, the scientists can now relax, but the engineers too that put it together. It was a successful launch a couple of days ago, and now it's in orbit. We'll see how it does, how it compares to Chandra. You know, it's not one of these multi-billion-dollar telescopes, but it is expensive. I didn't see the cost on it. And successful launch from the Launch Complex 39A. Same complex that has launched over half the amount of shuttles that have gone up, and the same launch complex that launched the Apollo 11 to the moon, and also the same launch complex that's now launching people from it using the SpaceX Falcon 9 system and using the Dragon crew vehicles. I think they're up to around five different crews that have gone up recently since last May. Well, it's not actually 21, so probably 2020 when they started launching the first crew of two. Since then, they've launched three different crews of four, including Inspiration 4, which was nothing to do with NASA. I mean, they launched four individuals to a higher orbit than the International Space Station on that one. They flew for 3 days. It was the one with the toilet problem, and they came back successfully after 3 days. Now they're going to have they've already got two more crew flights on the manifest for NASA number 5 and number 6. They also have another one on schedule for, I think, this February, a couple of months from now. They're launching four people for Axiom. Axiom is a company that's going to build another one or two modules. They are plans of attaching that to the International Space Station. That same company, once they're attached, will be sending up crews on a regular basis. For some reason, they're sending up a crew now without any of their modules attached to the space station. NASA approved it, and they're going to have four people come up and visit them for, a week to 10 or 14 days. Starting this February. So this is popular now. The Russians just sent home another crew of three. They just left today. And in fact, during the net, they probably landed in Kazakhstan. So comings and goings are getting more often between the crews and the cargo flights.
Paul, by the way, I have Kay's question.
This is another system that's going to be going up by this time, not only NASA, but NOAA. They plan on launching a flight very shortly. Probably next year. They're teaming up to see if they could take pictures on a regular basis using a synthetic aperture radar, which will be taking pictures of the ocean. The idea is to look for oil spills. Sometimes they're natural oil spills. They have one off of Santa Barbara on a regular basis that's been leaking for decades. that they use this test equipment. They attached a synthetic aperture radar system to the bottom of the plane and flew it back and forth in this one area where they noticed a natural oil leak. The test is the darker colors, you know, after they look at the pictures that come in, the darker colors are the thicker oil, and that would lead them to where the actual leak would be. And they ran tests, and sure enough, they could tell from the darker colors where the thicker oil is. To verify that, they sent boats out to Santa Barbara, out in the ocean, in the Pacific Ocean, and they sent down tubes, the tubes that are open on both ends. They put them into the ocean, and then they would close it, both ends, bring it back up, and then evaluate the tube, you know, the 2-inch diameter tube, and as the water settled, they could tell how thick the oil was. You know, let's say it's, you know, 1-inch thick, and they know that, well, this is a very thick area, and then they would do multiple tests, and then they evaluated the locations from this test UAV that they put up on a, you know, on the bottom of a, first they tested it on a real, you know, a plane with a crew, and then they used their UAV to test it to verify it, to see if the system worked, if it matched the dark colors that they were seeing, if they actually matched their, you know, a real test, sending a boat out and making these different tests to see if each tube that they pulled up was either thick or thin. And anyway, it apparently worked, and now they plan on actually developing a SAR system, a synthetic aperture radar system for a satellite, to do this on a regular basis, except on a global basis. And apparently, this will be a way to check for where leaks occur, either man-made oil leaks or natural oil leaks. So we'll look for that development in the next year or two as it comes online, as they're able to launch something like this. It'll be a big advancement and help in finding oil spills.
I'll call WB2AV.
Yes, Ed, go ahead.
You want 30 seconds on what that synthetic aperture radar means?
Yeah, I'd like that. That sounds good. I remember going over this with Dick a couple of times. But, you know, as they transmit down a signal, as the vehicle is moving, or spacecraft is moving, when that signal comes back up, it's actually hitting in a different place where it was transmitted. You know, it happens over and over again, and it duplicates having a very large radar. That's the way I understand it, but my guess is you're going to give me a better answer, Ed. Back to you.
Yes, you have an airplane or something like that with a radar on it, and you take a series of samples, say over a half a mile, and with proper processing and computers and everything, you can get the same antenna pattern effectively that you would get with an actual antenna that size, and you get some very precise, you know, very, very narrow beams effectively.
Yeah, and I know they have quite a few of them. And if I'm not mistaken, they could get a width sometimes maybe of a couple of hundred miles. I don't know if that sounds right, but a couple of hundred miles in a path a couple of hundred miles wide, just continuously going around the Earth. So over time, they could duplicate this and see how it looks from day to day, or from every couple of days to every couple of days. So hopefully they can do that with this. But the width, I'm not sure. Is it like maybe 50 miles or sometimes 600 miles, or it depends. What kind of a width can they get out of this thing?
I would assume that the scan length wouldn't be more than 5 or 10% of the altitude above the Earth. So if you're flying at 30,000 feet, your scan length would probably be 1,500 feet, which is still a really big antenna.
Yeah, it sounds good. I know every once in a while I see another satellite going up, and they say it's a star system, and you know it might be a rush from a mission from India or you know, European Space Agency launching something with a star satellite. And I know they don't get much airtime or no airtime as far as the news is concerned, but you know, being a radar, sending signals down. And I remember reading what frequencies they used at one time. I guess that depends. You know, I mean, you could have radars at 2.5 megahertz. Correct, 2.5 gigahertz. It sounds like a common number, but who knows what they're using in space. Anyway, thanks for that, because we'll follow this. You know, I'm fascinated with this one that's going to find oil leaks. And we'll see how it goes. And we'll look for that. There's another company, you know, all these companies I keep talking about that are launching rockets. This one hasn't done it yet, but there's another one that plans on having a reusable rocket, company called Stoke, S-T-O-K-E, and they've been in the news recently because they're getting a lot of money from another billionaire, Bill Gates. I guess he decided to jump on the rocket bandwagon. They're all doing that, of course. You have Elon Musk, you know, for SpaceX, and you have Peter Beck for the Rocket Lab, and one launching rockets on a regular basis from New Zealand, successfully recovering their boosters. They haven't relaunched their boosters yet, but they have plans of doing that. It's called the Electron Rocket. He plans on developing the Neutron rocket, which is going to be a larger version of the Electron rocket, except using a different fuel. They're going to use liquid methane. And we'll see how their reusability comes along. But here's another company now called Stoke. They plan on doing it without any heating tiles. You know, SpaceX has their version, their Starship, and they have a lot of these tiles all over it, similar to what the shuttle had, but they say there's a lot less of them. This company, Stoke, plans on doing it without any, whatever material they're using, I don't know yet, but they plan on building a spacecraft that, you know, could launch a two-stage system. The booster will come back, re-enter the atmosphere, similar to what SpaceX does. SpaceX boosters do not have any tiles on it, because they only get up to around, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 miles an hour. So their booster will re-enter the atmosphere and land vertically. So their second stage, you know, that's the Holy Grail, to get the second stage completely reusable. Starship at SpaceX has a plan on using, you know, heat tiles, these light, fluffy, insulating tiles that will, you know, be able to have their Starship re-enter the atmosphere. Well, this company plans on doing it without any trials whatsoever, so I'll be interested to see what kind of system this is. Their second stage will separate from the first stage. The bearings will open up and not detach. And out will come the payload, and that will go into space, and that will be the satellites that they deliver. Now the neutron by Rocket Lab also has the same type of deal where the fairings are going to open up, and then the payload will come out and be delivered to orbit, and then the fairings will close up and be able to be returned to Earth. It looks like this company, Stoke, will be doing the same type of deal. Bearings open up, payload comes out, bearings close, and then they start deorbiting and coming back to the atmosphere. How they're going to do it without burning up is beyond me. But they plan, they must have some kind of material or something, some kind of carbon type of material that could withstand this temperature that they're thinking about. The other thing I read with Neutron is they plan on coming back on a very, very, very shallow orbit, So they, it's going to heat up but over a longer period of time, and they should be able to get into the atmosphere that way. Maybe this company is planning on doing the same thing. We'll see in time. But again, he's being funded. One of the people, anyway, behind him is going to be Bill Gates. Mark Cuban, another billionaire. He's
next time
he's
complete.
So the company, Relativistic is the name of that company. They don't have it. They haven't done a launch yet either. We'll see. There's going to be a bunch of companies maybe next year launching these things. I think this one probably 2023 or 2024. But next year, anyway, there's another company called Firefly. They should be launching on a regular basis. We'll see. And, we'll report on them as they go. But Firefly, from what I understand, is not reusable. So they'll be, expendable vehicles, and then they'll be reusable vehicles. We'll report on it as time goes on. We'll see. There's another company, of course, Boeing, which we know of, and Lockheed, launching Atlas for many years. Atlas, they plan on retiring. And they're building the Vulcan spacecraft. They're pretty much ready to launch, but they need their engines. They're going to use two engines built by Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos, another guy who's like the richest guy in the world. He's building these VE3 liquid methane engines. Hopefully they can get that thing off the ground. They'll be put in the Vulcan spacecraft, which is designed to replace not only the Atlas V, which is going successfully for decades now, but also replace the Delta IV rocket engines. Delta IV uses the A-68 liquid oxygen rocket for getting off the ground with their boosters. But Delta is supposed to be replaced. Atlas is supposed to be replaced by this Vulcan engine, or Vulcan rocket with the BE-4 engines by Blue Origin. Anyway, I'm looking at the time, 11 o'clock. Any comments or questions before I turn it back to Roy? This is WS2N, Paul, for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet.
Paul, Kay has a question from the chat room.
Oh, good. Good. We'll read that. Well, unless you want to read it to me, that's okay. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, sure. I'll read it to you. They've been talking for a long time about how James Webb Telescope will not have any ability to be repaired when it's that far away. Why don't they add a small drone to the telescope, give it a camera and a radio control that we can communicate with and ask it to crawl over the telescope and fix things?
Okay, that's actually a good idea.